Right. Sure. Or maybe I follow her because I'm tired of being so removed from everyone, and I'm no longer sure it's the best way to be. Triss, I say. What are you doing here? She says bitterly. Shouldn't you be paying your respects? Shouldn't you? I move toward her. Can't pay any respects when you don't have any. I'm surprised for a moment that she can manage to be so cold. Triss isn't always nice, but she's rarely cavalier about anything. It only takes her a second to shake her head.
I didn't mean that.
Ah.
This is ridiculous, she says, flushing. He throws himself off a ledge and Eric's calling it brave? Eric, who tried to have you throw knives at Al's head?
Her face contorts.
He wasn't brave. He was depressed and a coward and he almost killed me. Is that the kind of thing we respect here?
What do you want them to do? I say, as gently as I can, which isn't saying much. Condemn him? Al's already dead. He can't hear it. And it's too late.
It's not about Al, she says. It's about everyone watching. Everyone who now sees hurling themselves into the chasm as a viable option. I mean, why not do it if everyone calls you a hero afterward? Why not do it if everyone will remember your name?
But of course, it is about Al. And she knows that.
It's...
She's struggling, fighting with herself.
I can't... This would never have happened in abnegation. None of it. Never. This place warped him and ruined him, and I don't care if saying that makes me a stiff. I don't care. I don't care.
My paranoia is so deeply ingrained, I look automatically at the camera buried in the wall above the drinking fountain, disguised by the blue lamp fixed there. People in the control room can see us, and if we're unlucky, they could choose this moment to hear us, too. I can see it now. Eric calling Triss a faction traitor. Triss's body on the pavement near the railroad tracks. Careful, Triss, I say.
Is that all you can say?
She frowns at me.
That I should be careful? That's it?
I understand that my response wasn't exactly what she was expecting, but for someone who just railed against dauntless recklessness, she's definitely acting like one of them. You're as bad as the candor, you know that? I say. The candor are always running their mouths, never thinking about the consequences. I pull her away from the drinking fountain, and then I'm close to her face, and I can see her dead eyes floating in the water of the underground river. And I can't stand it. Not when she was just attacked, and who knows what would have happened if I hadn't heard her scream.
I'm not going to say this again, so listen carefully.
I put my hands on her shoulders.
They are watching you. You, in particular.
I remember Eric's eyes on her after the knife throwing. His questions about her deleted simulation data. I claimed water damage. He thought it was interesting that the water damage occurred not 5 minutes after Triss's simulation ended.
Interesting.
Let go of me,
she says. I do, immediately. I don't like hearing her voice that way.
Are they watching you too?
Always have been, always will be. I keep trying to help you, but you refuse to be helped.
Oh, right.
Your help, she says.
Stabbing my ear with a knife and taunting me and yelling at me more than you yell at anyone else, it sure is helpful.
Taunting you? You mean when I threw the knives?
I wasn't taunting you, I shake my head. I was reminding you that if you failed, someone else would have to take your place.
To me, at the time, it almost seemed obvious. I thought, since she seemed to understand me better than most people, she might understand that too. But of course, she didn't. She's not a mind reader.
Why?
She says.
Because. You're from abnegation, I say. And... it's when you're acting selflessly that you are at your bravest. And if I were you, I would do a better job of pretending that selfless impulse is going away,
because if the wrong people discover it, well, it won't be good for you.
Why? Why do they care about my intentions?
Intentions are the only thing they care about. They try to make you think they care about what you do, but they don't. They don't want you to act a certain way, they want you to think a certain way. So you're easy to understand, so you won't pose a threat to them. I put my hand on the wall near her face and lean into it, thinking of the tattoos forming a line on my back. It wasn't getting the tattoos that made me a faction traitor. It was what they meant to me. An escape from the narrow thinking of any one faction. The thinking that slices away at all the different parts of me, paring me down to just one version of myself.
I don't understand why they care what I think as long as I'm acting how they want me to, she says.
You're acting how they want you to now, but what happens when your abnegation-wired brain tells you to do something else? Something they don't want. Much as I like him, Zeke is the perfect example. Dauntless born, dauntless raised, dauntless chosen. I can count on him to approach everything the same way. He was trained to from birth. To him, there are no other options.
I might not need you to help me. Ever think about that? She says.
I want to laugh at the question. Of course she doesn't need me. When was it ever about that?
I'm not weak, you know. I can do this on my own.
You think my first instinct is to protect you. I shift so I'm a little closer to her. Because you're small, or a girl, or stiff. But you're wrong. Even closer. I touch her chin, and for a moment, I think about closing this gap completely. My first instinct is to push you until you break, just to see how hard I have to press, I say. And it's a strange admission, and a dangerous one. I don't mean her any harm, I never have, and I hope she knows that's not what I mean. But I resist it.
Why is that your first instinct? She says.
Fear doesn't shut you down, I say. It wakes you up. I've seen it. It's fascinating. Her eyes in every fear simulation, ice and steel and blue flame. The short, slight girl with the wire-taut arms. A walking contradiction. My hand slips over her jaw, touches her neck. Sometimes I just want to see it again. Want to see you awake. Her hands touch my waist, and she pulls herself against me. Or pulls me against her, I can't tell which. Her hands move over my back, and I want her. In a way I haven't felt before. Not just some kind of mindless physical drive, but a real, specific desire. Not for someone. Just for her. I touch her back, her hair. It's enough for now.
Should I be crying?
She asks. And it takes me a second to realize she's talking about Al again. Good. Because if this embrace made her want to cry, I would have to admit knowing absolutely nothing about romance. Which might be true anyway.
Is there something wrong with me?
You think I know anything about tears? Mine come without prompting and disappear a few seconds later.
If I had forgiven him, do you think he would be alive now?
I don't know. I set my hand on her cheek, my fingers stretching back to her ear. She really is small. I don't mind it.
I feel like it's my fault, she says.
So do I. It isn't your fault. I bring my forehead to hers. Her breaths are warm against my face. I was right. This is better than keeping my distance. This is much better.
But I should have. I should have forgiven him.
Maybe. Maybe there's more we all could have done, I say. And then I spit out an abnegation platitude without thinking. But we just have to let the guilt remind us to do better next time. She pulls away immediately, and I feel that familiar impulse to be mean to her so she forgets what I said, so she doesn't ask me any questions.
What faction did you come from, for? I think you know.
It doesn't matter. This is where I am now. Something you would do well to remember for yourself. I don't want to be close to her anymore. It's all I want to do. I want to kiss her. Now is not the time. I touch my lips to her forehead and neither of us moves. No turning back now. Not for me. Something she said sticks with me all day. This would never have happened in abnegation. And first, I find myself thinking, she just doesn't know what they're really like. But I'm wrong. And she's right. Al would not have died in abnegation, and he would not have attacked her there either. They may not be as purely good as I once believed or wanted to believe, but they certainly aren't evil either. I see the map of the abnegation sector, the one I found on Max's computer, printed on my eyelids when I close my eyes. If I warn them, if I don't, I'm a traitor either way, to one thing or another. So if loyalty is impossible, what do I strive for instead? It takes me a while to figure out a plan, how to go about this. If she was a normal, dauntless girl and I was a normal, dauntless boy, I would ask her on a date and we would make out by the chasm, and I might show off my knowledge of Dauntless Headquarters. But that feels too ordinary after the things we've said to each other, after I've seen into the darkest parts of her mind. Maybe that's the problem. It's all one-sided right now. Because I know her. I know what she's afraid of and what she loves and what she hates. But all she knows about me is what I've told her. And what I've told her is so vague as to be negligible because I have a problem with specificity. After that, I know what to do. It's just the doing it that's the problem. I turn on the computer in the fear landscape room and set it to follow my program. I get 2 syringes of simulation serum from the storeroom and put them in the little black box I have for this purpose. Then I set out for the transfer dormitory, not sure how I'll get her alone long enough to ask her to come with me. But then I see her with Will and Christina, standing by the railing, and I should call her name and ask her, but I can't do it. Am I crazy thinking of letting her into my head? Letting her see Marcus, learn my name, know everything I've tried so hard to keep hidden? I start up the paths of the pit again, my stomach churning. I reach the lobby and the city lights are starting to go out all around us. I hear her footsteps on the stairs. She came after me. I turn the black box in my hand.
Since you're here, I say, like it's casual, which is ridiculous, you might as well go in with me.
Into your fear landscape?
Yes.
I can do that?
The serum connects you to the program, but the program determines whose landscape you go through. And right now, it's set to put us through mine.
You would let me see that?
I can't quite look at her.
Why else do you think I'm going in?
My stomach hurts even worse. There are some things I want to show you. I open the box and take out the first syringe. She tilts her head and I inject the serum, just like we always do during fear simulations. But instead of injecting myself with the other syringe, I offer her the box. This is supposed to be my way of evening things out, after all.
I've never done this before, she says.
Right here. I touch the place. She shakes a little as she inserts the needle, and the deep ache is familiar, but it no longer bothers me. I've done this too many times. I watch her face. No turning back. No turning back. Time to see what we're both made of. I take her hand, or maybe she takes mine, and we walk into the fear landscape room together.
See if you can figure out why they call me Four.
The door closes behind us, and the room is black. She moves closer to me and says,
What's your real name?
See if you can figure that out, too. The simulation begins. The room opens up to a wide blue sky, and we are on the roof of the building, surrounded by the city, sparkling in the sun. It's beautiful, for just a moment before the wind starts, fierce and powerful, and I put my arm around her because I know she's steadier than I am in this place. I'm having trouble breathing, which is normal for me here. I find the rush of air suffocating, and the height makes me want to curl into a ball and hide.
We have to jump off, right? She says.
And I remember that I can't curl into a ball and hide. I have to face this now. I nod.
On three, okay?
I nod again. All I have to do is follow her. That's all I have to do. She counts to three and drags me behind her as she runs, like she's a sailboat and I'm an anchor pulling us both down. We fall, and I struggle against the sensation with every inch of me, terror shrieking in every nerve, and then I'm on the ground, clutching my chest. She helps me to my feet. I feel stupid, remembering how she scaled that Ferris wheel with no hesitation.
What's next?
I want to tell her it's not a game. My fears aren't thrilling rides she gets to go on, but she probably doesn't mean it that way. The wall comes from nowhere, slamming into her back, my back, both our sides, forcing us together, closer than we've ever been before.
Confinement,
I say, and it's worse than usual with her in here, taking up half the air. I groan a little, hunching over her. I hate it in here. I hate it in here.
Hey, she says. It's okay. Here.
She pulls my arm around her. I've always thought of her as spare, not an ounce of extra anything on her. But her waist is soft.
This is the first time I'm happy I'm so small, she says.
Mm-hmm. She's talking about how to get out. Fear landscape strategy. I am trying to focus on breathing. Then she pulls us both down to make the box smaller, and turns so her back is against my chest, so I'm completely wrapped around her.
This is worse, I say,
because with my nervousness about the box and my nervousness about touching her combined, I can't even think straight.
This is definitely...
Shh. Arms around me. I wrap my arms around her waist and bury my face in her shoulder. She smells like Dauntless soap and sweet like apple. I'm forgetting where I am. She's talking about the fear landscape again, and I'm listening, but I'm also focused on how she feels.
So, try to forget we're here.
She finishes.
Yeah?
I put my mouth right up against her ear, on purpose this time to keep the distraction going, but also because I get the feeling I'm not the only one who's distracted.
That easy, huh? You know, most boys would enjoy being trapped in close quarters with a girl.
Not claustrophobic people, Triss.
Okay, okay.
She guides my hand to her chest, right under where her collarbone dips. All I can think about is what I want, which has nothing to do with getting out of this box suddenly.
Feel my heartbeat. Can you feel it?
Yes.
Feel how steady it is?
I smile into her shoulder.
It's fast. Yes, well, that has nothing to do with the box.
Of course it doesn't.
Every time you feel me breathe, you breathe. Focus on that.
We breathe together. Once. Twice.
Why don't you tell me where this fear comes from? Maybe talking about it will help us somehow. I feel like this fear should have vanished already, but what she's doing is keeping me at a steady level of heightened uneasiness, not taking my fear away completely. I try to focus on where this box comes from. Okay. Okay. Just do it. Just say something real. This one is from my fantastic childhood. Childhood punishments. The tiny closet upstairs. Shut in the dark to think about what I did. It was better than other punishments. But sometimes I was in there for too long, desperate for fresh air. My mother kept our winter coats in our closet, she says. And it's a silly thing to say after what I just told her, but I can tell she doesn't know what else to do. I don't really want to talk about it anymore, I say with a gasp. She doesn't know what to say because no one could possibly know what to say, because my childhood pain is too pathetic for anyone else to handle. My heart rate spikes again.
Okay, then I can talk. Ask me something.
I lift my head. It was working before, focusing on her. Her racing heart, her body against mine. Two strong skeletons wrapped in muscle tangled together. Two abnegation transfers working on leaving tentative flirtation behind.
Why is your heart racing, Triss?
Well, I barely know you.
I can picture her scowling.
I barely know you and I'm crammed up against you in a box for, what do you think?
If we were in your fear landscape, I say, would I be in it?
I'm not afraid of you.
Of course you're not. That's not what I meant.
I meant not, are you afraid of me? But am I important enough to you to feature in the landscape anyway?
Probably not. She's right, she hardly knows me. But still, her heart is racing. I laugh, and the walls break as if my laugh shook them and broke them, and the air opens up around us. I swallow a deep breath of it, and we peel away from each other. She looks at me, suspicious.
Maybe you were cut out for candor, because you're a terrible liar, I say.
I think my aptitude test ruled that one out pretty well.
The aptitude test tells you nothing.
What are you trying to tell me?
Your test isn't the reason you ended up in Dauntless? I shrug.
Not exactly.
No. I see something out of the corner of my eye and turn to face it. A plain-faced, forgettable woman stands alone at the other end of the room. Between her and us is a table with a gun on it.
You have to kill her,
Triss says. Every time.
She isn't real.
She looks real. It feels real.
If she was real, she would have killed you already.
It's okay. I'll just do it. I start toward the table. This one's not so bad. Not as much panic involved. Panic and terror aren't the only kinds of fear. There are deeper kinds, more terrible kinds. Apprehension and heavy, heavy dread. I load the gun without thinking about it, hold it out in front of me, and look at her face. She's blank, like she knows what I'm going to do and accepts it. She's not dressed in the clothes of any faction, but she might as well be abnegation, standing there waiting for me to hurt her the way they would. The way they will, if Max and Janine and Evelyn all get their way. I close one eye to focus on my target, and fire. She falls, and I think of punching Drew until he was almost unconscious. Triss's hand closes around my arm.
Come on, keep moving.
We walk past the table and I shudder with fear. Waiting for this last obstacle might be a fear in itself.
Here we go, I say. Creeping into the circle of light we now occupy is a dark figure, pacing so just the edge of his shoe is visible. Then he steps toward us. Marcus, with his black pit eyes and his gray clothes and his close-cut hair, showing off the contours of his skull. Marcus, she whispers. I watch him, waiting for the first blow to fall. Here's the part where you figure out my name.
Is he?
She knows now. She'll know forever. I can't make her forget it if I wanted to.
Tobias.
It's been so long since someone said my name that way. Like it was a revelation and not a threat. Marcus unwinds a belt from his fist.
This is for your own good, he says,
and I want to scream. He multiplies immediately, surrounding us, the belts dragging on white tile. I curl into myself, hunching my back, waiting, waiting. The belt pulls back and I flinch before it hits. But then it doesn't. Triss stands in front of me, her arm up, tense from head to toe. She grits her teeth as the belt wraps around her arm, and then she pulls it free and lashes out. The movement is so powerful I'm amazed by how strong it looks, by how hard the belt slaps Marcus's skin. He lunges at Triss, and I step in front of her. I'm ready this time, ready to fight back. But the moment never comes. The lights lift, and the fear landscape is over.
That's it?
She says, as I watch the place where Marcus stood. Those were your worst fears? Why do you only have four? Oh, she looks at me. That's why they call you. I was afraid that if she knew about Marcus, she would look at me with pity, and she would make me feel weak and small and empty. But she saw Marcus, and she looked at him with anger and without fear. She made me feel not weak, but powerful, strong enough to fight back. I tug her toward me by the elbow and kiss her cheek, slowly, letting her skin burn into mine. I hold her tightly, slouching into her.
Hey,
she sighs.
We got through it.
I put my fingers through her hair. You got me through it, I say. I take her to the rocks that Zeke, Shauna, and I go to sometimes late at night. Triss and I sit on a flat stone suspended over the water, and the spray soaks my shoes, but it's not so cold that I mind. Like all initiates, she's too focused on the aptitude test, and I'm struggling with talking to her about it. I thought that when I spilled one secret, the rest would come tumbling after, but openness is a habit you form over time, and not a switch you flip whenever you want to, I'm finding.
These are things I don't tell people, you know. Not even my friends.
I watch the dark, murky water and the things it carries. Pieces of trash, discarded clothing, floating bottles like small boats setting out on a journey. My result was as expected. Abnegation.
Oh, she frowns.
But you chose Dauntless anyway?
Out of necessity.
Why did you have to leave?
I look away, not sure I can give voice to my reasons, because admitting them makes me a faction traitor. Makes me feel like a coward.
You had to get away from your dad, she says. Is that why you don't want to be a Dauntless leader? Because if you were, you might have to see him again?
I shrug. That, and I've always felt that I don't quite belong among the Dauntless. Not the way they are now, anyway.
It's not quite the truth. I'm not sure this is the moment to tell her what I know about Max and Janine and the attack. Selfishly, I want to keep this moment to myself. Just for a little while.
But you're incredible, she says.
I raise my eyebrows at her. She seems embarrassed.
I mean, by Dauntless standards, four fears is unheard of. How could you not belong here?
I shrug again. The more time goes by, the stranger I find it that my fear landscape isn't riddled with fears like everyone else's. A lot of things make me nervous, anxious, uncomfortable. But when confronted with those things, I can act. I'm never paralyzed. My four fears, if I'm not careful, will paralyze me. That's the only difference. I have a theory that selflessness and bravery aren't all that different. I look up at the pit rising high above us. From here I can see just a small slice of night sky. All your life, you've been training to forget yourself. So when you're in danger, it becomes your first instinct. I could belong in abnegation just as easily.
Yeah, well, I left abnegation because I wasn't selfless enough, no matter how hard I tried to be.
That's not entirely true, I say with a smile. That girl who let someone throw knives at her to spare a friend, who hit my dad with a belt to protect me, that selfless girl, that's not you. In this light, she looks like she comes from another world. Her eyes rendered so pale they almost seem to glow in the dark.
You've been paying close attention, haven't you?
She asks, like she just read my mind. But she's not talking about me looking at her face. I like to observe people, I say slyly.
Maybe you were cut out for candor, Four, because you're a terrible liar.
I set my hand down next to hers and lean closer. Fine. Her long, narrow nose is no longer swollen from the attack, and neither is her mouth. She has a nice mouth. I watched you because I like you. And don't call me Four, okay? It's nice to hear my name again. She looks momentarily bewildered.
But you're older than I am, Tobias.
It sounds so good when she says it, like it's nothing to be ashamed of. Yes, that whopping 2-year gap really is insurmountable, isn't it?
I'm not trying to be self-deprecating, she says stubbornly. I just don't get it. I'm younger, I'm not pretty,
I laugh and kiss her temple.
Don't pretend, she says, sounding a little breathless. You know I'm not. I'm not ugly, but I'm certainly not pretty.
The word pretty and all that it represents seems so completely useless right now that I have no patience for it. Fine, you're not pretty. So? I move my lips to her cheek, trying to work up some courage.
I like how you look.
I pull back.
You're deadly smart. You're brave. And even though you found out about Marcus, you aren't giving me that look. Like I'm a kicked puppy or something.
Well, she says factually, you're not. My instincts were right. She is worth trusting. With my secrets, with my shame, with the name that I abandoned, with the beautiful truths and the awful ones. I know it. I touch my lips to hers. Our eyes meet and I grin and kiss her again, this time more sure of it. It's not enough. I pull her closer, kiss her harder. She comes alive, putting her arms around me and leaning into me, and it's still not enough. How can it be?
I walk her back to the transfer dormitory, my shoes still damp from the river spray, and she smiles at me as she slips through the doorway.
I start toward my apartment, and it doesn't take long for the giddy relief to give way to uneasiness again. Somewhere between watching that belt curl around her arm in my fear landscape and telling her that selflessness and bravery were often the same thing, I made a decision. I turn at the next corner, not toward my apartment, but toward a stairway that leads outside, right next to Max's place. I slow down when I pass his door, afraid that my footsteps will be loud enough to rouse him. Irrational. My heart pounds when I reach the top of the stairs. A train is just passing, its silver side catching moonlight. I walk beneath the tracks and set out toward the abnegation sector. Triss came from abnegation. Part of her innate power comes from them, whenever she's called upon to defend people who are weaker than she is. And I can't stand to think of the men and women who are like her falling to dauntless erudite weapons. They may have lied to me, and maybe I failed them when I chose Dauntless, and maybe I'm failing Dauntless now, but I don't have to fail myself. And I, no matter what faction I'm in, know the right thing to do. The abnegation sector is so clean. Not a scrap of trash on the streets, sidewalks, or lawns. The identical gray buildings are worn in places from where selfless people have refused to mend them when the factionless sector so badly need the materials, but neat and unremarkable. The streets here could easily be a maze, but I haven't been gone long enough to forget the way to Marcus's house. Strange how quickly it became his house, instead of mine in my mind. Maybe I don't have to tell him. I could tell another abnegation leader. But he's the most influential one. And there's still a part of him that's my father, that tried to protect me because I'm divergent. I try to remember the swell of power I felt in my fear landscape when Triss showed me he was just a man, not a monster, and that I could face him. But she's not here with me now, and I feel flimsy, like I'm made of paper. I walk up the path to the house, and my legs are rigid, like they don't have joints. I don't knock. I don't want to wake anyone else. I reach under the doormat for the spare key, and unlock the front door. It's late, but the light is still on in the kitchen. By the time I walk through the door, he's already standing where I can see him. Behind him, the kitchen table is covered with papers. He's not wearing his shoes, but on the living room carpet their laces undone, and his eyes are just as shadowed as they are in my nightmares about him.
What are you doing here?
He looks me up and down. I wonder what he's looking at until I remember that I'm wearing dauntless black, heavy boots and a jacket, tattoo ink on my neck. He comes a little closer, and I notice that I'm as tall as he is, and stronger than I ever have been. He could never overpower me now.
You're no longer welcome in this house, he says.
I stand up straighter, and not because he hates bad posture. I don't care, I say. And his eyebrows pop up like I just surprised him. Maybe I did. I came to warn you, I say. I found something. Attack plans. Max and Janine are going to attack abnegation. I don't know when or how. He watches me for a second, in a way that makes me feel like I'm being measured. And then his expression shifts into a sneer.
Max and Janine are going to attack, he says. Just the two of them? Armed with some simulation syringes?
His eyes narrow.
Did Max send you here? Have you become his dauntless lackey? What, does he want to scare me?
When I thought about warning the abnegation, I was sure the hardest part would be getting myself through this door. It never occurred to me that he wouldn't believe me. Don't be stupid, I say. I would never have said that to him when I lived in this house, but 2 years of intentionally adopting dauntless speech patterns makes it come out of my mouth naturally. If you're suspicious of Max, it's for a reason. And I'm telling you it's a good one. You're right to be suspicious. You're in danger. You all are.
You dare to come to my house after you betrayed your faction?
He says, his voice low.
After you betrayed your family? And insult me?
He shakes his head.
I refuse to be intimidated into doing what Max and Janine want. And certainly not by my son.
You know what? I say. Forget it. I should have gone to someone else. I turn toward the door and he says,
Don't walk away from me!
His hand closes around my arm, tightly. I stare at it for a second, feeling dizzy, like I'm outside of my own body, already separating myself from the moment so I can survive it.
You can fight him,
I think, as I remember Triss drawing back the belt in my fear landscape to strike him. I pull my arm free, and I'm too strong for him to hold on to. But I can only muster the strength to walk away, and he doesn't dare shout after me, not when the neighbors could hear. My hands shake a little bit, so I put them in my pockets. I don't hear the front door shut behind me, so I know he's watching me go. It wasn't the triumphant return I pictured. I feel guilty when I pass through the doorway to the pyre, like there are dauntless eyes all over me, judging me for what I just did. I went against the dauntless leaders. And for what? For a man I hate? Who didn't even believe me? It doesn't feel like it was worth it. Worth being called a faction traitor. I look through the glass floor to the chasm far beneath me. The water, calm and dark. Too far away to reflect any moonlight. A few hours ago I was standing right here, about to show a girl I hardly knew all the secrets I fought so hard to protect. She was equal to my trust, even if Marcus wasn't. She and her mother and the rest of the faction she believes in are still worth protecting. So that's what I'm going to do.
Listen on for more exclusive scenes from Divergent, told from Tobias's perspective.
First Jumper. Triss. I check my watch. The first initiate should be jumping any minute now. The net waits beside me, wide and sturdy and lit from above by the sun. The last time I was here was last year's choosing day, and before then, the day I jumped. I didn't want to remember the feeling of inching toward the edge of the building, my mind and body going haywire with terror. The awful drop. The helpless flailing of limbs, the slap of the net fibers against my arms and neck.
How'd the prank go?
Lauren says. It takes me a second to figure out what she means. The program. And my supposed desire to prank Zeke.
I haven't done it yet. Our work time didn't overlap much today.
You know, if you were up for some serious studying, we could use you in tech services,
she says.
If you're recruiting, you should talk to Zeke. He's much better than I am.
Yeah, but Zeke doesn't know when to shut it, she says. We don't recruit for skill so much as compatibility. We spend a lot of time together.
I grin. Zeke does like to surround himself with chatter, but that's never bothered me. Sometimes it's nice not to worry about providing any conversation. Lauren plays with one of the rings in her eyebrow, and we wait. I try to crane my neck to see the top of the building from the ground, but all I can see is sky.
Bet you it's one of my Dauntless Borns, she says.
It's always a Dauntless Born. No bet. They have an unfair advantage, the Dauntless Born. They usually know what's at the bottom of the jump, though we try to keep it from them as much as possible. The only time we use this entrance to headquarters is on choosing day. But the Dauntless are curious. They explore the compound when they think no one is watching.
They also grow up cultivating in themselves the desire to make bold moves, to take drastic action, to commit themselves fully to whatever they decide to do. It would take a strange kind of transfer to know how to do that without having been taught. Then I see her. Not a black streak like I was expecting, but gray, tumbling through the air. I hear a snap of the net pulling taut around the metal supports, and it shifts to cradle her. For a second I stare, amazed at the familiar clothing that she wears. Then I put my hand out into the net, so she can reach it. She wraps her fingers around mine, and I pull her across. As she tumbles over the side, I grab her arms to steady her. She's small and thin, fragile-looking, like the impact with the net should have shattered her. Her eyes are wide and bright blue. "Thank you," she says. She may look fragile, but her voice is steady.
"Can't believe it,"
Lauren says with more dauntless swagger than usual.
"A stiff, the first to jump? Unheard of."
She's right. It is unheard of. It's unheard of for a stiff to join Dauntless, even. There were no abnegation transfers last year, and before that, for a long time, there was only me. "There's a reason why she left them, Lauren," I say, feeling distant from the moment, from my own body. I pull myself back and say to the initiate, "What's your name?" She hesitates, and I feel, for a strange, brief moment, like I know her. Not from my time in abnegation, not from school, but on a deeper level, somehow. Her eyes and her mouth searching for a name, dissatisfied with the one she finds, just like I was. My initiation instructor gave me an escape from my old identity. I can give her one, too. "Think about it," I say, smiling a little. "You don't get to pick again."
"Triss,"
she says, like she's already sure of it.
"Triss," Lauren says. "Make the announcement for."
She's my initiate, after all, this transfer from abnegation. I look over my shoulder at the crowd of Dauntless members who have gathered to watch the initiates jump, and I announce,
"First jumper, Triss."
This way, they'll remember her. Not for the gray she wears, but for her first act of bravery. Or insanity. Sometimes they're the same thing. Everyone cheers, and as the sound fills the cavern, another initiate plummets into the net with a blood-curdling scream. A girl dressed in candor black and white. This time, Lauren is the one to reach across the net to help her. I touch a hand to Triss's back to guide her toward the stairs, in case she's not as steady as she seems. Before she takes the first step, I say, "Welcome to Dauntless." Careful, Triss. One abnegation, five candor, two erudite. Those are my initiates. I'm told that candor and dauntless have a fairly high mutual transfer rate. We usually lose as many to them as we gain. I consider it my job to get these eight initiates through at least the first round of cuts. Last year, when Eric and Max insisted on the cuts, I fought them as hard as I dared. But it seems the cuts are here to stay. All for the sake of the Dauntless Max and Eric want to create. A faction of mindless brutality. But I intend to leave Dauntless as soon as I find out what Max and Janine are up to. And if that's in the middle of initiation, so much the better. Once all the Dauntless Borns, including Uriah, Lynn, and Marlene, are with us, I start down the tunnel, beckoning them to follow with one hand. We walk down the dark hallway toward the pit doors.
"This is where we divide,"
Lauren says when she reaches the doors.
"The Dauntless Born initiates are with me. I assume you don't need a tour of the place."
She smiles, and the Dauntless Borns follow her down the hallway that bypasses the pit, leading them right into the cafeteria. I watch them leave, and once they've disappeared, I straighten up. I learned last year that in order for them to take me seriously from the beginning, I have to be hard on them from the beginning. I don't have Amar's natural charm, which won people's loyalty with just a smile or a joke, so I have to compensate in other ways. Most of the time I work in the control room, but for the next few weeks, I'm your instructor, I say. My name is Four. One of the Candor girls, tall, with dark skin and an energetic voice, speaks up.
Four? Like the number?
I sense the beginnings of an uprising. People who don't know what my name means often like to laugh at it, and I don't like to be laughed at, especially not by a group of initiates fresh from choosing who have no idea what they're in for. Yes, I say testily. Is there a problem?
No,
the girl says. Good. We're about to go into the pit, which you will someday learn to love. The Candor girl interrupts again.
The pit? Clever name.
I feel a swell of irritation, and I move toward her without really deciding to. I can't have someone cracking jokes about everything I say, especially not at the beginning of initiation, when everyone's attitudes are so malleable. I have to show them all that I'm not someone to be messed with, and I have to do it now. I lean in close to her face and stare at her for a few seconds until I see her smile falter. What's your name? I say, keeping my voice quiet.
Christina?
She says. Well, Christina, if I wanted to put up with Candor smart mouths, I would have joined their faction, I say. The first lesson you will learn from me is to keep your mouth shut. Got that? She nods. I turn away, my heart throbbing in my ears. I think that did it, but I can't be sure. Not until initiation really begins. I push through the double doors that open up to the pit, and for a moment, I see it like it's for the first time. The impossibly huge space, bustling with life and energy. The pulse of water in the chasm, crashing against the rocks, the echoes of conversation everywhere. Most of the time I avoid it because it's so busy. But today I love it. I can't help it. If you follow me, I say, I'll show you the chasm. The abnegation transfer sits at my table. For a moment, I wonder if she knows who I am, or if she's somehow magnetized to me by an invisible force of stiff that I can't help but give off. But she doesn't look at me like she knows me, and she doesn't know what a hamburger is.
You've never had a hamburger before?
Christina says, incredulous. The Candor are like that, amazed that not everyone lives the way they do. It's one of the reasons I don't like them. It's like the rest of the world doesn't exist to them. But for abnegation, the rest of the world is all that exists, and it is full of need.
No,
Triss says. For someone so small, she has a low voice. It always sounds serious, no matter what she says.
Is that what it's called?
Stiffs eat plain food, I say, trying out the slang. It feels unnatural applied to Triss. I feel like I owe her the courtesies I would owe any woman in my former faction. Deferential, averted eyes, and polite conversation. I have to push myself to remember that I'm not in abnegation anymore. And neither is she.
Why?
Christina says.
Extravagance is considered self-indulgent and unnecessary.
She says it like she's reciting it from memory. Maybe she is.
No wonder you left.
Yeah, Triss rolls her eyes, which surprises me. It was just because of the food. I try not to smile. I'm not sure it works. Then, Eric walks in, and everything goes quiet. Eric's appointment to Dauntless Leader was met with confusion, and in some cases, anger. There had never been a leader so young before, and plenty of people spoke out against the decision, voiced concerns about his youth and his erudite background. Max made sure to silence those concerns, and so did Eric. Someone would be outspoken one day and silent, frightened the next, almost like he'd threatened them. Knowing Eric, he probably did, with soft-spoken words that twisted together into malice, clever and calculated as always.
"Who's that?"
Christina says. "His name is Eric," I say. "He's a dauntless leader."
"Seriously? But he's so young."
I set my jaw. Age doesn't matter here. Connections to Janine Matthews do. He comes toward us and drops into the seat next to me. I stare at my food.
"Well, aren't you going to introduce me?" he says lightly, like we're friends.
"This is Triss and Christina," I say.
"Ooh, a stiff," says Eric, smirking.
I worry for a moment that he's about to tell her where I came from, and I curl a hand around my knee, clenching so I don't lash out and smack him. But all he says is,
"We'll see how long you last."
I still want to smack him, or remind him that the last transfer we had from Abnegation, who was sitting right next to him, managed to knock out one of his teeth, so who knows what the next one will do. But with these new practices in place, fighting until an opponent can't stand, cuts after just a week of combat training, he's right. It's unlikely that she'll last very long, small as she is. I don't like it, but there it is.
"What have you been doing lately, Four?" Eric says.
I feel a prickle of fear, worried for a moment that he knows that I'm spying on him and Max. I shrug. "Nothing, really."
"Max tells me he keeps trying to meet with you and you don't show up," Eric says. "He requested that I find out what's going on with you."
I find it easy to discard Max's messages, like they're bits of garbage blown toward me by the wind. The backlash from Eric's appointment as dauntless leader may not bother Eric anymore, but it still bothers Max, who has never liked his protege as much as he was supposed to. He liked me, though I'm not sure why, since I hole up alone while the other dauntless pull together. "Tell him I'm satisfied with the position I currently hold," I say.
"So he wants to give you a job?"
There's that suspicious probing again, oozing from his mouth like pus from a new piercing. "So it would seem."
"And you aren't interested?"
"I haven't been interested for 2 years.
"Well, let's hope he gets the point then."
He hits my shoulder like he means it to be casual, but the force of it almost pushes me into the table. I glare at him as he walks away. I don't like to be pushed around, especially not by scrawny erudite lovers.
"Are you two friends?"
Triss asks. "We were in the same initiate class." I decide to make a preemptive strike, to poison them against Eric before he poisons them against me. He transferred from erudite. Christina raises her eyebrows, but Triss disregards the word erudite, disregards the suspicion that ought to be written into her very skin after a lifetime in abnegation, and says,
"Were you a transfer too?"
"I thought I would only have trouble with the candor asking too many questions," I say. "Now I've got stiffs too?" As it was with Christina before, my sharpness is intended to slam doors before they open too much. But Triss's mouth twists like she tastes something sour, and she says,
"It must be because you're so approachable, you know, like a bed of nails."
Her face flushes as I stare at her, but she doesn't look away. Something about her seems familiar to me, though I swear I would remember if I'd ever met such a sharp abnegation girl, even for just a second.
"Careful, Triss," I say. "Careful what you say to me is what I mean. Careful what you say to anyone in this faction that values all the wrong things,
that doesn't understand that when you come from abnegation, standing up for yourself, even in small moments, is the height of bravery. As I say her name, I realize how I know her. She's Andrew Pryor's daughter. Beatrice. Triss. You look good, Triss. I'm not sure I remember what made me laugh, but Zeke said it, and it was hilarious. Around me, the pit sways like I'm standing on a swing. I hold the railing to steady myself and tip the rest of whatever it is I'm drinking down my throat. Abnegation attack? What abnegation attack? I hardly remember. Well, that's actually a lie. But it's never too late to get comfortable with lying to yourself. I see a blonde head bobbing in the crowd and follow it down to Triss's face. For once, she's not wearing multiple layers of clothing, and her shirt collar isn't pressed right up against the bottom of her throat. I can see her shape. Stop it, a voice in my head scolds me before the thought can go any further. Triss! The word is out of my mouth. No stopping it. Don't even care to try. I walk toward her, ignoring the stares of Will, Al, and Christina. It's easy to do. Her eyes seem brighter, more piercing than before. You look different, I say. I mean to say older, but I don't want to suggest that she looked young before. She may not bend in all the places that older women do, but no one could look at her face and see a child. No child has that ferocity. So do you, she says. What are you doing? Drinking, I think. But she's probably noticed that. Flirting with death, I say, laughing. Drinking near the chasm. Probably not a good idea. No, it isn't. She's not laughing. She looks wary. Wary of what? Me? Didn't know you had a tattoo, I say, scanning her collarbone. There are three black birds there. Simple. But they almost look like they're flying across her skin. Right. The crows. I want to ask her why she would get one of her worst fears tattooed on her body. Why she would want to wear the mark of her fear forever instead of burying it, ashamed. Maybe she's not ashamed of her fears the way I'm ashamed of mine. I look back at Zeke and Shauna, who are standing with shoulders touching at the railing. I'd ask you to hang out with us, I say, but you're not supposed to see me this way. What way, she says. Drunk? Yeah. Well, no. Suddenly it doesn't seem that funny to me. Real, I guess. I'll pretend I didn't. Nice of you. I lean in, closer than I mean to, and I can smell her hair, feel the cool, smooth, delicate skin of her cheek against mine. I would be embarrassed that I'm acting so foolish, so forward, if she had, even for a second, pulled away. But she doesn't. If anything, she moves a little closer. You look good, Triss, I say, because I'm not sure she knows it, and she should. This time she laughs. Do me a favor and stay away from the chasm, okay? Of course. She smiles, and I wonder for the first time if she likes me. If she can still grin at me when I'm like this, well, she might. One thing I know, for helping me to forget how awful the world is, I prefer her to alcohol. This is Aaron Stanford. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Four,
a Divergent collection by Veronica Roth. This program was produced by John Marshall Media, executive producer Caitlin Gehring. Text copyright 2014 by Veronica Roth. Production copyright 2014 by HarperCollins Publishers. All rights reserved. Thank you for listening.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.